morning. I welcome and I call the Ways and Means Committee to order and note for the record that a quorum is present. So welcome back, members. Our first order of business is the approval of the minutes from Friday, May 10th, 2024.
Madam Chair, can I move the approval of the minutes today?
Oh, yeah. Representative Garofalo, I would love if you would. Representative Lee Garofalo, would you like to move the minutes from Friday, May 10th, 2024?
Madam Chair, I'd like to do that, but I do have a slight amendment to the amendments. No, I don't. You hear the boo? Did you hear the boo for the...
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the minutes have been adopted. And so we are taking back up House File 5363. As I discussed last time, we thought last Friday would be our last meeting, we'd be able to do it, but because of the late breaking information, we thought it would be better to come back at 9 a.m. today and take our final action. So Representative Frederick did walk through the DE last weekend. Since then, there is another line and page amendment that was posted at deadline time, and we should have everything we need to take the action. There is one thing we do want Dee to come and speak to on the fiscal note before we take action on the second amendment, just so members have all the correct information before we take action on that. So that will be the order of operations today, and so I move that House File 5363 be placed on the general register. And I move the DE1 amendment. Representative Frazier, I know you described it last week, but would you mind reminding us?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Happy Monday, everybody. Good to be back. I hope everyone had a good weekend. The DE1 amendment, mainly what it did was it pulled in many of the changes that have been adopted on the Senate side as it moved through committee. And much of what that was were there were a couple of amendments that were brought over by our GOP colleagues. One was to require an actuary study every year instead of every other year, and another was to ensure that employers were notified when an individual is trying to access the leave. Other areas that were just a part of the main bills that traveled through committee were rate changes for rate setting, the appeals process, private plans, small business program, retroactive pay, and then technical clarifications as recommended by DE.
Thank you. So that is the DE1 amendment. And so I will, do we want to discuss, I think maybe get the bill in it, the form, or would folks be okay with that? And then we can have discussion about it overall. So the DE1 amendment before us, all those in favor, please. My apologies. We have the A24-0337 amendment. So I move the amendment coded A24-0337 to the DE1 amendment. And so please go ahead and describe that amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is what everyone got to see happen in real time on Friday before we laid it over and took a break for Mother's Day weekend. There was some clarity on an option that was provided back in February 24th by Milliman, the actuary group that's done the studies for us. And that clarity provided us with an option to address the 7-day qualifying period as a retroactivity payment week. So this amendment, this page and line amendment, lines things up with that option to ensure that that first week is paid and we have the correct rates based on the actuarial projections. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. And you have a spreadsheet here, and then we obviously have the fiscal notes that were already in our packets. And so I'm going to have Deed come up and just explain how this change impacts the fiscal. Briefly, we again have I think we have everything still here from Friday, and then we have an updated tracking sheet. So, welcome to the committee, Deputy Commissioner Evan Rowe. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, my name is Evan Rowe. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. So I think members in your, I believe if you have the February letter from Milliman, there are really two options. There are two different, the original fiscal note that you saw last week was based on option three. With the clarifications as proposed by the A24 amendment, as well as kind of reviewing the documentation from the actuarial analysis, the Representative Frazier's amendment makes the relevant piece of analysis option one, which I think can be found on page 10 of that letter. So essentially, it reduces the anticipated expenditures for paying that initial week. It additionally reduces the overall premium rate, which would be required to sustainably fund that program. The amount of premium reduction was from 0.96 in the first fiscal in calendar year 2026 to 0.88 in calendar year 2026. And the relevant details can be found on page 10 of that February letter. And happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Rowe. Discussion, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Rowe, so please explain to me the current status of the bill with regards to the first week and what this amendment would do.
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. So the amendment as Representative Frazier has provided it, there are a couple key provisions in the bill that this amendment would do. One is that so the bill already requires a 7-day qualifying event for somebody to be able to collect family or medical benefits. That is not the case for bonding leave benefits, which do not have a 7-day qualifying period. The 824 amendment additionally clarifies that those benefits are paid benefits which can be received under the 7-day qualifying event are paid retroactively. So essentially, an individual has a medical issue or a family care issue for 7 days, and then following the completion of that 7-day period, then those benefits are payable retroactively. So after that occurs, not payable proactively, it is payable retroactively.
And Lead Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Rowe, Commissioner Rowe, is this change, does it apply to just the first year of the benefit program, or is this going to be in perpetuity?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, this would be a permanent change for the program, would be our interpretation of the amendment.
Okay. Lead Garofalo.
Thank you. And Madam Chair and Commissioner Rowe, there was some testimony last week with regards to what the initial payroll tax will be in the first year of this program. First question is, which fiscal note do I reference to find that out? Second of all, is Deed really of the opinion that they can set the rate at what they want without the statutory cap that's currently in law for that first year?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, if I can take your second question first. Chapter 50, section, I believe, 41 of Chapter 59 of Laws 2023, provides the agency the authority to reset the premium rate based on the October 2023 actuarial analysis, subject, of course, to that 1.2% cap, premium rate cap, which is in statute. That is, and the intention there was for the, I think to ensure a balanced a program that is balanced actuarially. I'm sorry, could you repeat the first part of your question again?
Well, let's take this.
Lead Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, let's take the second part of that first. So you are referencing language in the bill that my recollection that is accurate. However, I don't believe that applies to the first year of the program. And in reviewing the law, it's pretty clear about that. Can you just, besides the provision you just cited, that is in conflict with other language in the law. Can you just provide some guidance on where the statutory authority is for Deed to have that flexibility you're mentioning in setting the tax? Can you just show us where that is? Mm-hmm. In law, beyond the section you just mentioned.
I'm going to go to Representative Frazier first, and then we can also have House research points to that as well. So, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, in the DE, we do provide to allow for Deed to make changes prior to the first year, if need be, based on the actuary studies. I don't have the line, but my staff is here. We need to get you directly to the page and line number.
Great. Maybe we can do that. Marta, would you be Marta James, Miss James? Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Miss James. I think you heard the question, so please introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, Madam Chair and members. I'm Marta James from House Research. So the provision that Representative Frazier was referring to, I believe, is in Section 42 of the DE-1, and I will get, yes. So It's on line 44.5, which allows that prior to January 1st, 2026, when the premium rates would start.
Thank you, Ms. James. Lead Garofalo. I know you had another question about the fiscal note in the as well.
Yep, and so, Madam Chair, the thank you, Commissioner. The first question I asked was with regards to the what the assumed payroll, like which fiscal note we reference for what the first year payroll tax will be.
And that be Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, I guess in regards, I guess I'm not understanding the question, but in regards to what specifically?
Lead Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Rowe. What will be the payroll tax initiated for the first year of the program, effective January 1st of 26?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, assuming Representative, assuming that the A24 is adopted and the bill passed into law, I just want to make sure I understand.
Yep,
oh, okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Based on the actuarial analysis, that would be 0.88 would be the sustained premium rate for the first 3 years of the program based on the recommendations of the independent actuaries.
Lead Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And either Deputy Commissioner Rowe or staff, which fiscal note do we reference for that and which part of it, or do we just not have an updated one for that?
It looks like we have House Fiscal who's willing to come up for this.
Madam Chair, members, Ashley Eng, House Fiscal. The House File 5363-1E fiscal note is currently under revision as of this morning. There is a tracking sheet that was included in your materials on Friday that reflected that fiscal note. However, with the amendment, there was a new tracking sheet distributed, and that has a date time of this morning. The bottom table of that tracking sheet has the new 0.88 premium rate and reflects revenue and expenditures with that model.
Lead Garofalo.
Okay, so we're going to base this up. This is current year 26, not fiscal year.
Madam Chair, I did it in calendar years because the program will operate on calendar years.
Okay, super. Thank you. And so originally, I believe this was in non-part, I'm asking this question, was 0.7? Is that where we were at before?
See, head shaking, confirming, yes.
Okay. And so 0.18, we're looking at about a 25% increase in the payroll tax. In terms of dollar cost, this increased payroll tax, I don't have a baseline that I am seeing here. Unless I'm reading the spreadsheet wrong, I'm just.
Madam Chair?
Yep.
Ms. Eng.
Oh, there we are on the top. I'm sorry.
So, yes. The top table, I'll explain the whole thing. Sorry.
Thank you.
The top table reflects the end of session with the 0.7% rate, and then the premium formula as laid out in Chapter 59 of Session 23. So the middle table describes the alternative scenario provided in the actuarial study from October, and the third table provides the new scenario based on the change from the alternative scenario from the actuarial study.
Okay.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had not, this was on me, not on staff. I had not had a chance to review the spreadsheet beforehand. So it goes up to 0.93 in calendar year 29. That's what the tells. Okay. So instead
That's
of the,
correct.
Thank you. Instead of the point, I think we were looking at the notes we saw last week for 0.96. Was that what the, so this takes it to 0.93. And if you wouldn't mind just explaining the change that we're making to the program in the first week. Last week we were there was discussion of if you had a PTO balance of a certain amount, it applied or didn't apply. Does someone want to cover whether that is pertaining to this or not, or if this is an addition to that, or if this revises that, whether you, the author, or Deed?
We can do that, and I think you're hitting on the salient points of why we're here today, Lee Garofalo. So I'll go to Representative Frazier first, and then we can take it from there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, that PTO buy-down piece will be is being removed, and it will no longer be a part of the. Well, I should say, in the House version of this bill, that was removed in the first committee stop. It is not being added in at this point, so it will not exist.
Okay, and, Lee Garofalo.
And thank you. So, and previously we had mentioned in previous testimony is that we were lining up with the Senate. Is the Senate version have this vision we're adopting today?
The Senate,
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, the Senate version has gone through ways. So it is the Senate version does have the PTO buy down with a sunset clause. The idea would be that the Senate version would eventually line up with the House version.
Okay.
Representative Garofalo, and I'll just say I think what happened too is some of the information that came to light last week with this committee hearing actually with is why we're here and why the changes are different. And unfortunately the bill had left Senate Finance by the time we had seen the information. So we're working on the most up-to-date information in the House here, and that's why this other amendment was offered by Representative Frazier, which I think you're tracking on, but just for saying that out loud for everybody. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And just to clarify, and again, this is for either the author or nonpartisan staff. So the changes we're making today, how does this make the payroll tax less higher than was originally stated? What is the, I don't want to call it a benefit reduction, but it is. It's a benefit reduction from the baseline. How does it end up saving money?
I think we have Deputy Commissioner Rowe again. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. So the fiscal note that you saw, the version that you saw last week where you had the 0.96, 1.01%, that was based on option three from the actuaries. That was the assumptions there were not relevant to the actual Minnesota program. And what I mean by that is that in option three, that contemplated a program with no 7-day qualifying event requirement, right? So that would essentially be that would have been if you were able to take leave immediately upon being sick. Now, that is not the case in the Minnesota program. That shouldn't have been in the fiscal note, but essentially, what the spreadsheet right in front of you shows is in the proposed program is a 7-day qualifying event with that benefit being paid retroactively. What you saw last week in the fiscal note was essentially if there had been no 7-day qualifying event. So Minnesota's program in that way is less generous than some states like Colorado, Oregon, where there is no 7-day qualifying requirement.
Lead Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the Deputy Commissioner, so the 7-day qualifying event, with the exception of bonding events, is retroactive. And as a result of that, people who may have had anticipated a 5-day event or something less than that, those benefits will no longer be covered. That's the result of the savings.
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. If there was no 7-day qualifying event, that would increase the cost of the program.
Lee Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so we are not looking at the the premium rate scenario in front of us. We're not modifying the starting balance. We're still starting off with a balance of about $600 million. We are seeing a substantial premium increase. So this is, I guess this is going to be the first of a series of problems we're going to see with this bill, but I don't want to debate the underlying bill, and we're on the amendment right now, so I'll keep those comments for later. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion to the A24 amendment. Representative Rarick.
I just have one quick question, because the rest of my questions will be for the underlying bill, too. So. Was the improper payment rate incorporated into the current fiscal note that we're looking at?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, can I ask what you mean by improper payment rate?
Sure.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in every state here too, for example, unemployment insurance has a 9.9% improper payment rate. Some of it's fraud, some of it's just honest mistakes, but there's approximately a 10% error rate, for lack of a better explanation. Some people call it an improper payment rate. Some states have as much, I think Virginia has a 45% improper payment rate. And I'm wondering if you've incorporated at least a bare minimum of what we already see here in Minnesota with UI, although this is not apples to apples at all with UI, because UI is very precise. It's been true and tested for decades. This is not unemployment insurance. It's not even remotely close to that. So have you included some sort of an improper payment rate in the current spreadsheet, since we don't have the fiscal note in front of us and I can't see what the assumptions are?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, thanks for clarifying that. Yes, the assumptions that the actuaries make naturally, you know, are rooted in the programmatic experience in other states and in similar, you know, plans that you would see, you know, comparable private plans around the country. So the answer to your question is yes, it does assume, you know, those types of various elements in terms of improper payments and what have you, all the kind of relevant salient financial details that would be required in terms of establishing expected expenditures in such a program.
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it does, but what, since we don't have an updated fiscal note in front of us, unfortunately, which I really do not like, what are the assumptions and what is that error rate? Is it 10%? Is it 45%? Is it somewhere in between?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, so I think the terminology that you're using is primarily kind of a UI, you know, United States Department of Labor term. I don't think it is, you know, I think as far as it goes within the actuarial analysis, we could certainly see what they used in terms of that specific assumption, but I wouldn't say that it is a, the actuarial study uses, you know, the actual payment data from other states, which bakes those pieces in. So I think it is an assumption that is baked into all of the expenditure data. I don't think it is it's not a specific line item. In other actuarial analyses, they don't model that as a specific line item because I think it's an element of that bottom line number that you see. And if you go back to the actuarial analysis and if you see, you know, look at page 10, I think you would see you'd kind of see the results. As they're pointed out, it's not a specific subline item. It generally isn't in actuarial analyses, but it's something that is reflected in that bottom line.
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll keep the rest of it for after we adopt the amendment, but I think it's important to understand what is and what isn't. The spreadsheet from from Friday till today is, I would call it dramatically different. In calendar year 29, it was a 1.01%, and now we're seeing, slightly less, a 0.93% of it. Talking hundreds of millions of dollars. Anyway, I'll keep the rest of it for later, but I just wanted to clarify what exactly is in here, what's accounted for.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the commissioner or the bill author, you know, if that is baked in, what else is baked into the fiscal note that we don't know about that's not decipherable when we read through it? To me, this would be an item, that should have a line item. In all the fiscal notes that we've seen, I've not seen where any assumptions are made for these improper payments. And we know they're going to happen. I think it's, I don't know why it's not in here, but what other items might be baked in that you've sort of alluded to that item being baked in? What other items might we be missing that would throw all these numbers off?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I guess when the legislature required that the administration conduct an actuarial analysis keeping with practices across other state programs around the country, right? That is exactly what we have done. I would say that the actuarial analyses that you have in front of you are entirely in keeping with the way that those actuarial analyses have been done in other states, exactly in line with what the legislature has requested. And again, I guess what I would just say is, you know, in no actuarial analysis from any other state that I have seen, do they list every single line item, because that would, you know, mean you'd have like a report that would be 300 pages long in all likelihood. I would just say that what goes into an actuarial analysis are program, you know, the, you know, the program, you know, kind of population statistics, the nature of the program that is being modeled, you know, the natural kinds of operational considerations that you are raising, such as improper payment rate or other elements that go into the administration of the program, as well as the other operational details that you need to consider in setting up a program. But that, you know, and it's done by qualified independent actuaries who are accredited and have a specific methodology. So I think the point is, this is exactly how an actuarial analysis has been undertaken in other states. I don't think, you know, I think it's very much in line with the intentions of the legislature in that regard.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the Deputy Commissioner, so how will we know what that rate is going forward?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, as we set up the program and when the program goes live on January 1 of 2026, we'll have a variety of operational metrics that we'll be tracking. We'll be sharing with the legislature, payment rates across, you know, various demographic groups. There are a bunch of reporting requirements that are already enumerated in Chapter 59. We will also be subject to legislative oversight and audit oversight and all those other elements. So I think, again, this you guys are absolutely right. This is this program integrity is absolutely critical. It is, I would say, one of our agency's absolute top priorities as we set this up. However, when you're doing financial projections for a program that hasn't yet begun, you're looking at the experience of other states. By using the experience of other states, you can then forecast what the experience is going to be in Minnesota. Once we get the program up and running in Minnesota, we'll have real historical data that we'll be able to share. And again, we we'll be able to have robust conversations once the program is up and running. But what I would just say is, this is based on real data from other states, from private insurers. So those elements are incorporated into the actuarial analysis in that way.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. this is a little bit on the frustrating side, but thank you for the line of question.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, to the commissioner, it sounds a little bit like we have to start the program in order to tell you what you're going to get charged in the program. I'm deeply confused by that. But question for you. In, I think it was October, Milliman modeled a scenario for you that or your department said didn't actually reflect the law, and they modeled that based on unpaid first week for medical. What was Deed's interpretation of the law relative to the work that Milliman did for you on that?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, just to your first statement, I think option one of the actual, what you have in front of the table actually does demonstrate that we know exactly under Representative Frazier's amendment what the initial premium rate would be in calendar year 2026, and that would be 0.88 based on the recommendations of the actuaries. The February letter that you have in front of you outlines three different scenarios. Option one, which is the one, you know, which is the basis for the spreadsheet and for the bill, reflects a 7-day qualifying event for a 7-day qualifying event requirement for non-bonding claims, with payments for that 7-day qualifying event being payable retroactively, as well as no qualifying event for bonding claims. The second scenario, which hasn't been the subject of discussion, but just since it's in the packet, I can briefly mention it, would contemplate no waiting period for all family claims and then a 7-day waiting period for medical claims. The third scenario is no 7-day qualifying event required for any type of claim and all those claims being payable immediately. But again, just to reiterate, it is that first option with the 7-day qualifying event and retroactive payments for non-bonding claims that is the subject of discussion today.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I guess you just said that you did know that number, but you just told Representative Scott that you didn't know that number. You didn't have that at your hands. But let's move on to some other question that I have for you. On the DE, page 44.9, it says, based on program historical experience and sound actuarial principles. Is there a definition that is used professionally? Is that something that you can point to as to what that contains? Because it seems to me that if you had sound actuarial principles, to I think Representative Scott's question a little bit ago, you could have detailed what those things were that were sort of lumping into your assumptions and your numbers. She had a lot of questions around the actuarial studies, but you spoke in very vague and broad sweeping terms, not really understanding what that is, but that strikes me as a little bit of an incongruence when you say in lines 44.9 that you're going to use sound actuarial principles. Not being an actuarial myself, thank God, just wondering if that's something that they teach in actuarial school or if that's more of a term of art.
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm also not an actuary. However, the legislation requires that we contract with independent qualified actuaries, and I would say that the Society of Actuaries and the American Academy of Actuaries probably have a more these are professional accreditation bodies that have their own standards. I would say that the use of the phrase sound actuarial principles in that sense is more of a term of art, but it is a term of art that is, that is rigorously and independently verified by those bodies. I would say that the reason you have it in the legislation is more to ensure that the department and the administration are running the program in comportment with those types of principles. Now, I think those principles, there are a variety of principles in that regard, but I think fundamentally it's about ensuring that we have a sound and stable program for the long haul.
Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, the number of non-answers has been, or the number of answers have been surpassed by the number of non-answers, so we'll just come back to this after the DE has gone through.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple more questions have come to mind. So is there has the reserve amount in the fund, has the reserve amount changed since the bill was passed last year? And if so, what factored into that?
Is that Deputy Commissioner Rowe?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, are you talking about, if I can just ask a clarifying question, are you referring to as of today or as proposed by the legislation?
Representative Scott.
Well, what can the taxpayers expect? How has it changed since passage of the bill to today? As far as what the reserve amounts that Deed thinks are adequate for this fund.
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott. So, again, I would say that, since there has been no legislation passed, but since last year and today, nothing has changed as of today. However, as contemplated by this legislation and rooted in the recommendations of the actuaries, this can be found on page 7 of the October 2023 report, the actuaries do recommend changing the fund balance to a 25% target of reserves. The reason they do that is that's based in line on funding policies and I'm quoting directly from the report here, based on funding policies in other states with PFML mandates and on the target surplus levels reported by insurance companies for short-term disability insurance products. So the recommendation within the bill is directly rooted in the recommendations from the actuaries in their legislatively mandated October 2023 report.
Representative Scott, and I do want to just remind folks we are on the A24, and I think the question was broader, and we can have more discussion. So I just want to work towards adoption of or moving to a vote on the A24. So do you have another question on the A24 specifically?
Madam Chair, I guess first, before we move on to that, I'm wondering, since we're on the subject, if the testifier could tell us what that reserve amount is, what it was initially in numbers supposed to be, and then with the new actuarial information, what is Deed's intention?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe, we'll do this last question, and then we'll move to a vote. Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
So the original legislation, in some ways this may be a better conversation for subsequent, because there's a tie to the premium formula, which is being proposed to be changed in the underlying bill. I would think about it
in terms of percentages of program benefits, though, because ultimately, when one has a program reserve to be able to ensure that you have enough cushion to be able to continue to pay benefits, the original legislation targeted a program reserve of around 33% of annual benefits. Again, based on the actuary's analysis and experience in other states and from private insurers, they instead recommend a target balance percentage of 25%. That is largely because family and medical benefits are very predictable in terms of their outlays. Unlike unemployment insurance, which tends to be very cyclical and very seasonal, family and medical benefits are more predictable. They're rooted in kind of population health statistics. So that is the rationale behind the actuary's recommendation of changing the target balance percentage.
Representative Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you really didn't answer my question, because I asked in dollar amounts what that is. I know the percentages, but what I was trying to get at is what's the bottom line, how much money needs to be in the fund. But I will move on, because it doesn't sound like I'm going to get an accurate or a real answer out of that. But who directed Milliman to model a scenario paid, for that first week of bonding? So that didn't exist in the October report. So did Deed direct them to model a scenario for that first week of bonding?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, the department did ask for additional scenario.
Representative Scott, let's do one more question on this, and then we'll take another crack at everything when we get the bill in the shape, too.
I'll reserve my other comments for the bill.
Okay, sounds good. So I move the amendment coded A24-0337 to the DE1. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No. No.
The motion prevails, and the amendment to the DE1 has been adopted. So to the DE1 as amended, we'll vote on this, and then we'll do member discussion.
Thank you.
So I move the DE1 as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No. No.
The motion prevails, and the DE1 as amended has been adopted. So now we are to the full bill and to discussion, member discussion. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For either the author or the commissioner, so if the payment dries up and the reserves dry up, where are the payments going to come from?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, I guess I don't think that that's a realistic scenario, in the sense that the proposed, as you can see in the report, as you can see, in the underlying legislation, the initial, setting the premium rate of 0.88% as contemplated by the bill as amended would provide for robust reserves to ensure that there is a sufficient balance in the program to be able to continue to pay benefits. We will also be conducting annual actuarial analyses to make sure that that things stay on target. I think part of the reason that we propose moving to annual actuarial analyses is to ensure that we're able to kind of take into consideration any new updates and changes and make sure that the program is on financially sound footing.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the commissioner, I understand what your plan is. I'm from the emergency services field where you hope for the best and you plan for the worst, and it seems like you're planning for the best. My question is, and I'll take one more shot at it here, what happens if we drain it out? I can point to numerous fraud investigations and very large frauds that have happened. What happens if our numbers don't match in the first year, and where are we gonna get that money from?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the scenario that you outline is not realistic in that sense, in that this is rooted in, I mean, these data are rooted in, rooted in an independent actuarial analysis based on a detailed analysis of population statistics based on experience and programs from other states. Certainly we have seen stories from around the country around some of those elements, but that's, again, I think the sort of what if scenarios here are not realistic for this purpose. Of course, if program expenses are higher than anticipated, we will be doing an annual actuarial analysis and adjusting premiums annually. However, the program is starting with a projected initial fund balance of $591 million. That is a very robust fund balance, given the predictability of benefit payments and the resourcing of the program.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just take one more shot at it. Commissioner, have you been directed not to give a number or to give a path?
That's not appropriate to ask the Deputy Commissioner. He's trying his best to answer it. So,
Madam Chair, if we're not going to get an answer, then I'll give up the mic then. Let somebody else take a shot.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, let's talk about something that I'm really good at talking about. Let's talk about IT. You put out, I believe, January, a limited RFP for the software component of this. Can you tell us how many vendors you sent that out to? Just as I'll have a couple of IT questions, Madam Chair.
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, it was a public invitation to negotiate. So it was open to all. I guess it was open to all vendors. I don't have the. I would say that we had. I don't actually know exactly how many it was sent out to, but it was open to. It was open to literally any vendor that would seek to bid on state business. So we weren't just sending it out to individuals.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Nash, and I will say, as it relates to, I think we can have a bit of a discussion, but this bill has gone through a lot of committees. An IT vendor-related question isn't specific to kind of the jurisdiction of why we're here. So if we could try to, I get assumptions, premiums, fiscal notes, there's a lot of interaction between all of it, but I think that's getting a little far afield to vet the process for how they got to what tech platform or whatnot. So
Madam Chair, thank you. The fix bill does have some components to the IT aspect of the program. So, software takes a long time, Commissioner. I don't think any of us are excited to talk about some of our great failures in the past. My concern is that we're going to be looking at another great failure. Can you tell us where the responses are on the RFP? How many have responded? I'm hoping you have that number. And based on those responses and that scoping, where the costs are and when we can look at a finish date.
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, and I appreciate the question. So I would say that we are in negotiations right now. So I can't speak specifically to numbers of vendors right now because we are currently, we have, I'd say, commercially sensitive conversations underway. With that being said, what I can say to your previous question, this was sent out to dozens of vendors. I would say that we had very robust vendor response. I would say that we are pleased with the responses that we have gotten. And I know that's it's general, but again, given the fact that we are in the middle of an active procurement right now, I can't go a whole lot in more depth than that. I will say we are acutely aware of the nature, the need to, to create, to ensure that we have a best-in-class delivery approach. I would say that we have, learned the lessons from across the state enterprise. We are employing best practices from really around the country in terms of how we're seeking to deliver this program. In-house workforce, we were able to kind of talk a little bit more about our approach in that regard. Members of this committee who serve on House Workforce got to see a very nerdy and detailed presentation around our kind of product management approach. We've brought in leadership in the room, in fact, the former director of the the former deputy director for operations from the Massachusetts program. I think we are really seeking to learn from what has worked, and I think we're really in a strong position to be able to set up a best-in-class program here in Minnesota.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last question on this. The question that I had asked about meeting delivery date was not answered, and the question is germane to the overall cost of this program, which is contained in this bill. We are here talking today about the cost of this program, the IT parts of this. I have not heard whether you're going to hit deadline, whether you're not going to hit deadline, and feelings don't care. Doesn't matter to me, to anybody. Feelings have no place in this discussion. We need to know whether the IT vendor, and you don't have to share who it is, because that's I would jump up and scream at you if that were the case. But what we need to know is, are they, the vendors, in their conversation telling you, yes, your proposed go live date is achievable in reality, and using best IT practices, throwing a joke at the best actuarial practices, can they actually say, yes, we're going to get this done with a firm answer, sir?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. And I would say that we are already delivering, in the sense that some of the initial functionality required to deliver wage detail reporting for employers has already partially gone live in the unemployment insurance program, and would be very happy to give you a more fulsome briefing on kind of those components at your convenience, Representative. But yes, we are confident in our ability to hit on the dates. Our vendors are as well, and we look forward to delivering.
I'm going to write that down, Madam Chair, that we're on track and we're going to deliver. I'll be amazed.
Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say thank you to Representative Frazier and all your work on this. This is a bill that we passed last year that is going to change people's lives. And these are adjustments we need to make because of sound actuarial studies, and that's why we're here today. But I can't help share a little personal experience with this. I have three kids that are all adults and are, have jobs. Thank you. But their jobs don't always carry the best insurance. And I know with the quite of a few teachers in our family, as the education finance chair, that 75% of our population in our public schools are women. Women tend to have babies. And if you're a brand new teacher, usually means you're young, and usually means that you're starting your family. And they don't have the sick leave to cover that. So they're planning or trying to plan pregnancies around summer, trying to figure out what they're going to do without that paycheck, and then also trying to figure out how they're going to afford childcare. So this is something that I think is really important for our state to do, and I'm glad that we're adjusting it and that you've spent all this work on trying to get all the parties to the table. So just wanted to say thank you.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to return to a couple conversations we had just had, and when we were talking about the improper payment rate, I'm just going to call it that because I don't have another name. I didn't want to call it fraud because it's not. It's honest mistakes. It's all of it. So I'm just going to call it that. Maybe that's not in the realm of paid family leave, but we'll just call it that for now. So I read through the Millman report from October, and I believe you said it was on page 10. So I read page 10 and page 11. And unless I'm missing something, I don't see anything in the actuarial report that talks at all about any kind of improper payment. There's nothing, no terminology there. Maybe you could point it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Representative. I think maybe there was maybe a little confusion. I think when I was referring to page 10, that was about the February report, which is just the tables for this.
Representative.
Thank you. That's fair. Well, if we had the updated fiscal note in front of us, it should be in the assumptions. I don't know if it is or not because we don't have that, so I have a problem with that, just like I had said. Let's talk about something else, though, that leads into the improper payment rate. It can be anywhere, like I said, for UI, which is a very different program. It's very defined. There's, like I said, decades worth of checks and balances that are baked into it. They have, in my estimation, the Unemployment Insurance Agency is one of the best agency that we have in the state of Minnesota, and they are frequently the best in the nation. And they still have a 10% improper payment rate. So you had said a couple different things in your testimony since you and I just talked about that. And you talked about that we modeled this after the state of Washington. And I happen to know that they almost went bankrupt in their first year. That's a problem. So I don't know what their improper payment rate is. I don't know what's baked into this because we don't have an updated fiscal note. I don't know if it's in the assumptions or not. I'm wondering if you could help us understand if you've based this on, modeled it after Washington, that's a problem because they almost went bankrupt. If you want to speak to that. The other thing, before I give up the mic, you also said that you've looked at Massachusetts. And I believe Massachusetts actually has like a private insurance company as a vendor. As opposed to a state actor creating a system, creating our MNSHR or MNLARS program here in Minnesota. So can you help me understand those two things? So you talked about Washington, they almost went bankrupt, and talk about Massachusetts, which I believe actually has a private sector vendor, like an insurance company. I won't name them, but if I remember correctly.
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative. I'll try to go through each in sequence. So just on the UI kind of improper payment rate, that is a very technical definition from memory, and I'd probably have to consult half a dozen federal regs to know the exact remember the exact definition. But improper payment rate includes things like an applicant providing the wrong information, the agency then paying it off of that information. It's a very, I guess the federal government has very kind of specific and technical standards for defining those elements that I don't think really tie, that don't necessarily tie to sort of the real program experience or expenditure. So, but happy to have a conversation on that at some point if that would be of interest. As far as, the Washington State experience, I wouldn't say that Minnesota's program is solely based on Washington. It's based, Minnesota is the 13th state to be implementing a paid family and medical leave program, and I would say that the bill, with the amendments and this bill, really I think reflects the best of all the different states. You've seen, I think, a highly successful program launched recently in Colorado. You've seen, there will be a dozen states live in Minnesota by the time Minnesota goes live. And specifically to the Washington kind of financial issue, the state of Washington did not do an actuarial analysis before they went live. They set their initial premium rates too low. We have now done actuarial analyses by qualified independent actuaries, and they have stated that the rates, as proposed for the program that we're launching, are sustainable and feasible and actuarially sound. Regarding the kind of the different operating models for state programs, so Massachusetts doesn't have a contracted vendor. I think you might be thinking of Connecticut. They use Aflac to manage some of their claims administration, and there are a variety of operating models that one can consider.
I'd say that we've tried to look at all of them and pick the best. I think we've tried to hire a great team that's going to be able to deliver a great program for Minnesotans. But that is, I guess, maybe just to close, I think one of the benefits of being 13th in the country is that you can learn from what worked and what didn't and take what works. And that's really what we're trying to do here.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so to that point, to the bill author, Representative Frazier, so it seems like we've had a lot of concern on this side of the aisle about improper payments, whether it be fraud or mistake or other. And I'm just wondering what is in the program to get at that, to like verify information and, for example, unemployment insurance, there's a lot of verification. There's an appeals process. It's pretty stringent. So what are we doing in this system to prevent or counter fraud, first find fraud when it happens, but to stop it from happening? And then if it does happen, what's the reclamation process? So how do we claw that back?
Representative Frazier.
Madam Chair, thank you. There are procedures and processes set in place in the bill, but I do know that the Deputy Commissioner knows in detail what those are, because some of them have been adjusted based on recommendations to ensure that we have the proper mechanism in place to catch those things and have a reclamation process to get that money back. That's a great question. I'm going to let him.
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, I could point you to a couple sections in the underlying statute that would speak to that. There's a whole section 268B.185 that is on benefit overpayments, and this, I think where it makes sense, we really have tried to model a lot of both last year and this year, have tried to model things off of Minnesota's unemployment insurance program, which, as you know, is, I would say, justly nationally recognized for its strong performance. So, so essentially, the department has authority to claw back money if somebody is misrepresenting it. We have the authority to work with county attorneys if the theft rises to the level of criminal procedure. Additionally, in this bill, we have built out a very robust appeals mechanism. That is rooted in the unemployment insurance system, and intentionally so. We've adopted it that way to make sure that there's process convergence and kind of legibility, so that you can have a strong sense of program integrity. I guess the last piece I would say is there's a role for employers in this program essentially when somebody applies for leave. Employers are going to be notified by the department, and that'll be another chance for them to share information with us. And I guess just the last thing I would say is, as we set up this program, since we are kind of setting it up from the ground up, we have an opportunity, I think, to use really intelligent and thoughtful approaches to make sure that. That we have integrity through every single step of the process. There's been a lot of good innovation happening around the country in that regard, and we certainly expect to leverage it.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Final quick question. So let me just give you something that I've thought of. So say we've got grandma in Florida, grandma needs care. This is one of those things that you could use to go take care of grandma in Florida. What if you had 10 family members all sign up to say, we all need to go take care of grandma? What if it was 20 or 30 or 50, and all of a sudden it became a big family reunion using paid? So how do we prevent something like that? Is there going to be something in the system where we're going to cross-reference to say how many people are actually taking care of this one person? Is there going to be some kind of look built into the system to red flag that?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, the answer is yes. I think what you're outlining is an example of of family leave, right? So, if you have caregiving leave, essentially, caring leave will require the healthcare provider of the person receiving care signing off on the medical necessity for that individual to sign up. So essentially, we would be collecting information on who is receiving care, as well as who is the caregiver, and we'd be able to cross match between the two. So absolutely, that is something that I think is a pretty common analysis in every other state. And we would certainly expect to build and run our system in a way to ensure integrity in that vein and across other dimensions.
So finally,
Representative.
Thank you. So finally, Madam Chair. So I'm just wondering if the bill author would let us know if there's a limit, because, you know, at what point do we know that's too many? Is it 3? Is it 5? Is it 10? Is it 20? Is it 30? Is it 50? Because that's human nature, you know. There, people will try all kinds of things. So I'm just wondering if you've thought about that, and is it actually in the language of the bill?
Representative Frazier.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Rarick, I would say it's human nature for people who want to take care of people that are close to them, that they love. That's human nature. Mm-hmm. I understand your concern here is whether or not people use that as a way to attempt to commit fraud in this system. I hate that we always default to that position or that perspective, but here we are. I don't believe we have a particular limit, but we do, as Deputy Commissioner just described, we do have parameters to ensure that we capture things like that and we are able to prevent them or reclaim if they actually do happen.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I wouldn't want to be the person to say, well, 3 is okay, but 4 is not. 5 is okay, but 6 is not. I mean, where do you draw the line? I mean, this is difficult stuff. And when you make something so broad like you have, and I could have said the same thing for the neighbor next door, right? I mean, this is so broad, and I'll tell you this. I'll just use schools as an example. When I've talked to administrators at schools, whatever amount of pay time off, however it is, vacation time, sick time, whatever, that is allowed, people take it. So I'm just saying, maybe it's just my district, I don't know. And I see we've got somebody objecting to that across the aisle, but that's fine. That's just what I've heard from my district, that whatever is allowed, people take it. And they're owed it, and they can do it, and they certainly can do it. I'm just saying that I wouldn't want to be the person at the agency going, well, no, that's crossed the line. How do you know? Like, how will they know when it's like it's too much? It's beyond the scope of what it should be.
I think, Representative Rarick, I think your last two questions have kind of been on these scenarios and these points of how much is too much, you know, or what are the lines. And I think I've heard Representative Frazier answer it, and yeah. Again, being we're running low on time and want to make sure this bill gets vetted through that, we'll leave that as a comment.
I don't need a
question. Okay, great. So we'll move on to Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to revisit a line of questioning that I had one more question for, and then I want to talk about what is and isn't a covered employee on page 5. First of all, in talking about the solvency of the program, so we know that, like the state of Washington, not only did they almost go bankrupt in the first year, but also the third year. And it really concerns me that we're going to continue to have to raise this tax to make sure that the program is solvent. So my question is to the commissioner, or assistant commissioner, deputy commissioner, is what happens if, in order to keep the program solvent, the tax has to go over and above what is the statutory limit?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think you have a statutory limit, you have a statutory premium cap in the law, and I think what that would do is that would force a discussion certainly within the legislature and with the administration to do that. Now again, you have a 25, you have a substantial premium, you have a substantial premium reserve, so there is a significant fund balance. And I would just reiterate, you know, the difference between Minnesota and the Washington experience that's being cited. The actuarial study in Washington State wasn't done until the third year of the program, as you note. So I think by doing the work up front here in Minnesota, we are going to be in a much better position to have a sustainable and sound program that, again, our objective is to provide a program that's very predictable, both for applicants so that they know they can count on the care, as well as for employers, because we want them to have predictability in terms of what that rate will be. That's why we've done the actuarial analysis, and that's why, as we update it every year, people, employers will be able to have confidence in terms of where the rates are likely to go.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my next questions have to do with who's a covered individual. And I see that we're giving pretty broad rulemaking authority to DEED to determine. So, you know, in this day and age, we have a lot of remote employees, right? Some may not even live in this state. So my question is, and it goes into the fiscal part of this, because depending on how you define who's covered, that could really dramatically raise or lower the cost of the program. And I don't think that's figured in actuarially. Correct me if I'm wrong. But what does DEED kind of foresee? How are you going to define what an employee is if they live out of the state of Minnesota? Do they have to be coming to the state of Minnesota for meetings once a year, twice a year, 3 hours, 1 hour? What do you anticipate that looking like?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott. So I would say a couple things. First of all, I think you're absolutely right that remote work has changed a lot in terms of overall employment. I think the exact reason and the exact reason that we want to be able to conduct rulemaking in that regard is because it is complicated, and it's because we want to make sure that it that the tests that can be drawn are reflective of the feedback from stakeholders in the business community as well as from other interested parties. So I think it's a technical element. The intention though is that we are able to get to a standard that's really legible for businesses, and that's feedback that we've heard from the employer community as we've gone throughout developing this process. I would also say that the actuarial analysis does contemplate the covered employment standard as is contained within law.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, if the actuarial analysis covers that, where in the actuarial study is that? Because you haven't determined what that definition is. So how can they base any future numbers on that if we don't know through the rulemaking process? And my other question is when do you anticipate having those rules in place so businesses can have that certainty?
Representative Frazier.
Just a clarifying question for Representative Scott to make sure I'm tracking this. Are you, in your scenario with remote work, are you saying if there's a remote worker that is allowed to participate remotely doing their job, but they're still paying their part of the premium, and employer still paying their part of the premium, that person should be shut off on those benefits?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'm saying, Representative Frazier, it's not defined in the bill what a covered individual is in those scenarios where people may be working in Wisconsin or wherever, name the state, but are they going to be, are they 100% remote? Do they have to, how are they going to be eligible if they're going to be eligible at all for this program? What is that threshold for which they have to actually, if there is one, have a presence coming to Minnesota? Or is it broad? Is D going to settle on, well, if they're a state employee, even if they live in California, they're going to be eligible for the Minnesota program? That's what I'm getting at, Representative Frazier. It's wide open here. So to the DEED commissioner, if I could have you answer, when do you anticipate having those rules adopted so that businesses have some certainty on how that's defined?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, again, I would say that is exactly why we want to, that is why we want to conduct rulemaking on this, because rulemaking is, I would not say that rulemaking is wide open. Rulemaking needs to pass a test of reasonableness and make sure that those elements are, feedback from stakeholders across the various stakeholders that are impacted by the program are able to do that. Now, I would say that, and I would say that through rulemaking, I think we can get to a greater, greater clarity than perhaps currently exists today. I would also note that, our intention and expectation is not that is you know if somebody's a state employee but, you know, lives in California year-round, no, that would not, you know, that's not the type of covered employment. That would not be covered employment. Again, I think that the first two tests that are in the statute, 50% or more of the year is performed, or in the quarter is performed in Minnesota, or 50% or the employee's residence is in the state 50% or more of the calendar quarter, and some of the employment is performed in Minnesota, is a clear standard, and it is one that can be understood. We will conduct rulemaking to ensure that, you know, for those kinds of scenarios where remote work is trickier, we are able to develop standards in consultation with the business community and other stakeholders.
Representative Scott, and I'll just say, just for time's sake, we have three more members on the list, plus Lee Garofalo, I assume, would like to make some comments. I would like to just take a moment at the end to give my final comments on my last Ways hearing, too. Mm-hmm. And so we'll just be mindful of that. So we'll go back to you for one question, and then Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
I'm very sorry. You know, you had asked about timeline, right? You know, we are certainly hoping that we can have draft rules up in the coming months and we are certainly hoping that we're going to be able to promulgate rules, hopefully by end of year, so that businesses have lots of time to be able to prepare for it and the rule, and we will be working as quickly and as thoroughly as possible with the business community to make sure that folks have as much time to prepare as possible.
Representative Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just wrap up with this, and I wish you well. I hope the program is successful. I do, but I feel like the anticipation is great, and I just hope this doesn't end up being like a Scud missile back in the day, right? There's all this anticipation, and every single one of them was a dud. I just think that the questions here haven't been answered adequately. I know it's a new program, but we have some guidelines from other states, from the UI program here. I feel like this is seriously a shot in the dark, and the targets that are, you know, we're wanting to reach, they're never going to be reached, just like the Scud missiles never reached their targets. I just have great concerns about this program. We don't have a good track record in the state of Minnesota with MNLARS and with MNsure. Cost overruns, timing is way past what it should be. But I do. I wish you well. I hope it works. I do. Thank you, Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair, for the line of question. Yeah.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I do want to say that I think Deputy Commissioner Rowe is doing a great job as well, and thanks for being on the hot seat and answering all these questions. I think you are answering the questions. You know, I've heard a lot here about what's baked in, and we all know that when we have fiscal notes and the way we do things around here, a lot of times we're not able to bake in all of the things that really come from a program or come from a change in our law. And I'll tell you some things that I don't think are baked in here. I don't think we've baked in how much workforce we're going to attract with this new program, or how much more workforce we're going to retain with this new program in the state. We haven't baked in how much healthier our babies are going to be and our families because of this program, or the savings in the understaffed caregiving workforce that we all struggle with so much. You know, none of these things are baked in, but they're going to be results of this program when it comes online. I've heard a lot here about concerns about the taxpayers, and I just want to remind everyone the people using this program are taxpayers. They are. These are the people, it's going to benefit our taxpayers. This isn't just one side, oh, somebody's paying and not getting. This is where everybody's going to benefit from this. You know, so I just think that the parade of horribles on this is, you know, just really completely overblown, because this is a program that has been carefully thought through and is going to have incredibly wonderful benefits for this state that we can't even begin to count right now as we sit here, but they are real benefits. They're going to be financial, but they're also going to be real benefits in people's lives. And just, you know, one other piece of this, too, is that It is just incredible that in this country, we don't provide the kind of basic benefits that almost every other country provides for new families. Time off for having a baby. I mean, it's just incredible that we don't provide paid leave in this country. It's almost as though we didn't want people to have babies. Just imagine what, you know, people worried about, you know, our population isn't growing, people aren't having babies. Well, let's treat them like we want them to have babies and give them some time off when they do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And earlier we heard a lot of talk about these benefits that are here. And I'd like just to really kind of have some a little bit better transparency and clarity. These are mandates. No one gets to choose them. These are mandates. And the problem with mandates is that whatever the mandates represent, people, agencies, it all comes at their cost because that's the ones who have to pay for it. And if I could kind of put an analogy together about what this really means, those of you that are chairs around this table, if you were to begin to put together your finance budget bill and leadership says, oh, by the way, you need to put in your bill, this particular bill that includes additional costs to you, and oh, by the way, you're not getting additional targets, and we have no idea what the tails are going to be, you're going to have to cut stuff out of your budget, right? Well, companies who produce, and it doesn't matter if it's a nonprofit or service organization or whatever, you have a limited amount of budget that puts into your personnel costs. And so when you add more cost to that, it has to be taken away from something else. And so ultimately, actually it's going to be the employee that's going to get cost charged with this cost. Because the employer is going to have to determine, okay, now who do I lay off? How do I get the same productivity out of fewer people or with less cost? And so ultimately, the way, as one representative said, workforce is going to increase. Yeah, because you got to have find people to replace it, the people that are time off. Now, medical leave is important, and that's a really wonderful thing to do. But through all of time, all of history, whenever there's been jobs out there, everybody has had to decide what to do in regards to that. This is not a new problem. This is a newer solution, and it's one that I think we have a lot of work to do. But ultimately, when we figure out how we can help people come better off this year compared to last year, we understand the best way to do it is by increasing standard of living. You increase standard of living by increasing productivity. And this is actually going to be a reduction of productivity because it's going to require more people to do the same job. Philosophically, it's going to end up, I think, costing the average employer raises, etc. We already heard McDonald's running losses because of the $20 minimum wage in California. All of this stuff comes to a cost. And unfortunately, we think we can just mandate it and all of a sudden it's going to materialize. There is a cost to everything, and I think this is a mistake, a direction that's not going to prove well into the future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. If the order had been different, I would have gone right after Chair Liebling. I would have just been done because that was amazing. But I do feel the need to respond to some of the things that Representative Petersburg had to say. And I guess expanding on some of the points made by Chair Liebling, so let me say, right, the details do matter. So it's good that we're digging into details. And as Chair Liebling said, we want to make sure we're not only looking at details on one side of the equation and missing those on the other. And we don't want to miss the big picture that this will, in fact, save lives. Research out of California, their six-month paid leave in California saved 340 infant lives. Now, how could that possibly be? Well, reduced poverty, reduced food insecurity, increased postpartum care, even reductions in pediatric abusive head trauma. You talk about raising standard of living. This does do that. This is about that. And the problem with not doing this is that you end up having a race to the bottom among employers, right? That those larger employers who can offer paid leave end up having an advantage over other employers. It hurts small businesses trying to compete with those larger employers. As Chair Liebling said, we are the only developed country that does not have this. And we don't need to look far afield. You go to International Falls, go over the bridge, Fort Francis in Canada, offers 12 months paid leave, because that's required in Canada, 12 months, right? So what we're talking about is way, way less than that. So what I would say is we want to recognize as we're doing this that, of course, the details matter. We have folks working incredibly hard on that. And we know that there's going to be a massive impact that is so positive for Minnesotans and for the development of babies and for families and for all kinds of things as we go forward. So I'm so grateful to represent Fraser and folks working on this. We don't want to lose the big picture that this is an enormously positive step forward for Minnesota. Thank you, Chair.
For the discussion, I think last now we go to Lead Garofalo to close before we take a vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, in my last committee hearing in the legislature, I am so thankful that I get to look at my DFL colleagues and say the following words. See, I told you so. See, I told you so. Last year, we told you guys this was going to happen. We told you your assumptions were messed up, your taxes were too low for the benefits that you set up, and like people in need of hearing aids, you just chose not to hear us. We told you this, and now, in less than a year, the program isn't even up and running yet, and you're already jacking up the tax by 30%. 30%. So now we're looking at what's nearly a 1% payroll tax on every Minnesotan who's paying this. And as we're going forward and we're laying out these concerns about the benefit set not being aligned with costs, we're once again being told that everything's fine. Members, I'll look at your own language, page 5. Page 5. Entities that are excluded under this section may opt into coverage following a procedure determined by the commissioner. In such cases, services provided by employees are considered covered employees under subdivision 15. Sounds good. The commissioner may adopt rules that further define the application of this subdivision. They may also establish the criteria for covered employment for individuals that do not meet the criteria. You don't know who it applies to. How do you model the cost? How do you model the tax when you don't define in the bill who it's going to apply to? You're giving it to someone else to decide with the promise that in the future you're going to come back and figure it out. So the benefit set that you have right now that you've put in your bill is less generous than Washington's PIT tax. It has a higher benefit cap than Washington's program. Yet you're telling us that the payroll tax is going to be lower than Washington's? No. No, it doesn't work out. So as we're looking at this, I hear words like highly successful. Yeah, highly successful at taxing the snot out of Minnesotans. An over 30% increase in the program isn't even up and running. We haven't even talked about the technology side of things. Yeah, you guys are going to get a program up and running in 21 months. And I'll be the starting quarterback for the Minnesota Vikings this fall. Give me a break. Okay, it's not like the DFL and this governing majority have a solid track record of technological administration. MinLars, MinSure. Remember the MinSure debacle? The bureaucracy was so overconfident in that they named the conference rooms after sitting DFL legislators. And now they're telling us everything's going to be fine. So again, what we are seeing here is a cost structure out of alignment. These benefits are out of line with the payroll taxes. This will put Minnesotans on track for higher taxes and diminished benefits. The reality is we're being told there's only two solutions here. Well, either you do nothing or you accept the Canadian-style mandate, government's going to tell everyone what to do program. No, there's a lot of other choices out there, and the reality is Minnesota's employers and employees do that today. Everyone? No. But you had a chance to put in an opt-in program. You had a chance to provide flexibility, to leverage the infrastructure that's in place. And right now, the only way people can opt out of this mandatory program is by saying everything prescribed in this bill, you have to follow. So this is a preview of coming attractions. You're going to see a lot more problems. But the good news is that accountability is on the way. Because if you listen to the employers right now, they're already saying it publicly, okay? Eventually, when this goes live, okay, they're going to be reducing benefits. And when employees ask why their benefits are being reduced, Madam Chair, they're going to blame you guys. They're going to blame you, and they are saying it very explicitly, okay? The benefit sets that are being offered right now are going to be replaced by the DFL's one-size-fits-all approach. And Minnesotans aren't going to like it. So when that accountability comes, I can't tell you, but it's on the way. I'm voting no on this bill today. I would encourage members to not smoke the hopium that everything's going to be fine. And look at these bills, look at the math involved. And Madam Chair, thank you. I'll be voting no.
Thank you. We're going to Representative Frazier for final words on your bill before a vote. Go ahead, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hate to have to follow that, but Representative Garofalo, I would pay to come watch you play quarterback for the Minnesota Vikings. Let's say I know that guy. This is going to be a great program for all the reasons that were stated by Representative Lieben and Representative Pinto, and also I believe some of my colleagues over here on the GOP side, they believe it will be a great program for Minnesotans as well. I haven't heard workers say, give us less benefits. Give us less things that will help us take care of ourselves and take care of our families and loved ones when we need to have something that will prevent us from going into financial ruin. This is a program that will help that. This is a program that will invite people to stay in their jobs. This is a program that will incentivize people to apply for jobs and help out some of our small businesses that can't offer this benefit. And there are a lot of our workers that don't have these benefits right now, and they're looking forward to the time when this program is going to go into effect. I heard Representative Peterberg, I think, said that this is a new idea. It's not new. The rest of the world has been doing this for a very long time. You know, we're catching up. We are catching up. And I'm proud that we're going to be the 13th state to do this. Vote yes.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. And with that, I renew my motion that House File 5363, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 5363, as amended, has been placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for being here twice with us. So this is actually, hopefully, truly our last hearing. Maybe, you know, ways, and I probably cursed it. I also thought today would be short. But I did want to genuinely, yes, so lead Garofalo.
Yep. Yes. Madam Chair, I know you're going to give a closing statement. Yes. I just wanted to thank you and your staff for doing a good job of running the committee this year. This is a very difficult committee to run. I mean, of course, I'll never find out what it really is like to run it, but, you know. But I can watch it, and I've observed other people, and I just wanted to thank you. I know you'll give a shout-out to the majority party staff, nonpartisan staff, and others. I just wanted to take a minute to thank my friend and colleague, Harry Kennedy, here. I've had the opportunity to work with Harry for about 10 years. Hardworking, smart, the state of Minnesota, the Republican caucus. We're, in fact, the legislative chamber is very lucky and very fortunate to have your expertise and talent here. You're a good friend, and one of the hard parts of leaving this is me leaving friends and leaving you. So I just wanted to say for all your service, and again, it's not to call out every, you know, there's a lot of other people that will be thanked here. Harry, I just wanted to say thank you for all the work we did together on the committee, outside of it, even when we disagreed. It was always fun, and I just wanted to say thank you, that I'm going to miss you, and Minnesota's fortunate to have you. So thank you. Yep.
And then I will also just want to reiterate thank yous to all of the staff. So Dave Sullivan, Harry Kennedy, for your outstanding research, sometimes frustratingly so. And then to Emily Adrians and Colby Sullivan. Again, this committee, a lot happens outside of this room with what we do, what we're responsible for, what we stay up late worrying about, rooms we're locked into together. And Colby and Emily have been there through and through and keep this running with integrity and what's best for the institution, and have been honestly the best ways team that you could ever hope for. And to Leah Killian, who's kept the ships running and is probably trying to get a committee report rushed over to make it to 11 and wishes I wasn't saying thank you, but I am. So, and to Owen Wirth, who is just absolutely the best committee administrator, who has a great line of communication with the GOP, with all of us. Has been there, stepped into this role, and has just been incredible as a partner in all of this. And to Vice Chair Edelson, who this is her last committee as well as Vice Chair, and to go out and has been just a great confidant and helpful in making sure we run this committee. Lead Garofalo, you genuinely have been a team player in ways that are just really thoughtful and considerate. You never back down on what your GOP needs from you, and you've also been really great about making sure the committee functions well, which you throw sand in the gears when it needs to be thrown, but you have also just been genuinely incredibly kind, incredibly thoughtful, and someone that we've had a great line of communication, and I've appreciated that, and I did offer to let him chair, but understanding that he has wielded a gavel before and, you know, appreciate that. And I just want to say thank you, a genuine thank you to my DFL colleagues. You are a force, and you come in here, and sometimes it means biting your tongue. Sometimes it means doing the work behind the scenes that we have to do internally to make sure the bills are ready to come to Ways, have our NOCs, have our policy work, have everything we do, our finance work happen before we even come in here. But you are genuinely like team players through and through and have made this committee an honor to be a part of. And to the GOP for honestly very thoughtful, respectful, you know, frustrating at times, but you have all been incredibly good to work with. I think I only had to gavel down Graffalo once. So I just wanted to say, like, over-the-top thank yous, because I think last year was kind of cut short with a busy committee hearing. And I want to thank our pages as well for all of their work. The committee folders are not small for this committee and often happen late. So I hope I didn't miss anyone, but want to just genuinely say thank you. And I hope I don't see you in a committee room again anytime soon. So with that, we are adjourned.